Hi, this is Mark Margolis. I played Tio on Breaking Bad. And if you don't start listening to Mr. Media, I'm going to have to ding my bell.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to legendary rock photographer Bob Gruen, who's just released a film, Ike and Tina, On the Road, 1971-72. It's an intimate look inside the professional and personal lives of Ike and Tina Turner. This is his second time around on our show. Stick around, because you know by now we never, ever do anything nice and easy. We always do it nice and rough. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by the Stitcher app for mobile devices. Give it a test drive today at stitcher.com/mrmedia, Mr. Media. I love this free radio app, and I think you will too. stitcher.com/mrmedia. Today's episode of Mr. Media Interviews is brought to you by GoDaddy.com. You know GoDaddy.com from their wild and sexy commercials, but isn't it time you actually test drove their web hosting and domain registration services yourself? For a limited time, Mr. Media listeners can save 10% on the already low price of web hosting services at GoDaddy.com by entering the promo code POD4 at checkout. Again, that's 10% off web hosting when you go to GoDaddy.com and enter the promo code POD4, that's P-O-D, the number 4, at checkout. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of former Ikeettes who have finally noticed my smooth moves on the dance floor and, while wearing a headset, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
I tell you what.
I want you to go with me sometime, like I go with you.
Okay, okay. I'll tell you what.
I don't want to go this time.
No, you got it.
No, I want to go when I want to go. Same way you do.
No, you got it.
Don't let me force.
No,
to stay with today's trend in dressing, today's trend in music.
Do I love you, baby, my own mind? With all the dick, I'm on the run. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because of the death of my show being as exciting as it is, and we couldn't rely on records, so therefore we had to keep the show strengthened to play for all the different audiences as we have been playing. I sort of write about, I get sort of tired of writing about the man and the woman unless it's something really different, really strong.
I guess you know by now that we never, ever do nothing nice and easy.
My buddy Jeff Chabon used to do marketing and promotion for Phantasma Productions in West Palm Beach, Florida. And whenever he could, Jeff arranged for me to have amazing tickets to concerts that Phantasma brought to the Tampa Bay area. And I always paid in full, newspaper rules, folks. The show that made the greatest impact on me? It had to be being in the second row for a Tina Turner concert. I'm thinking it was around 1986 when I was music critic for the Tampa Tribune. Tina, I think, was at the height of What's Love Got to Do with It, a time when we learned all the kinds of unpleasant things about her relationship with ex-husband Ike Turner. Now, standing there, looking up at the stage, those long, 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 incredible legs, watching her shake and shimmy and belt out all those classics, it was absolutely mesmerizing. It was amazing. It was astonishing. It was intoxicating. Pick your word. It was just, it was incredible. And one more thing, that woman was so hot. I'm telling you. Anyway, so I couldn't help but be interested in watching Nadia and Bob Gruen's new film, Ike and Tina, On the Road, 1971-72. It's a hybrid of a classic concert concert footage interposed with the Ike and Tina Turner review on the road, plus extremely rare footage, I think, of the Turners at home with their children. I wouldn't call it a documentary per se, because it lacks a narrative or even a narrator. It's just kind of a slice of life type of thing. But the presence of a young, raw Tina Turner, Annie Mae Bullock, makes it thoroughly compelling. I love this woman. I guess I always have. She's dynamic. She's so explosive on stage. And yet, in the film, we really see how sweet and unassuming she is in the rest of her life. It's almost like two different people. Like, you know, when she goes on stage, she's got this. She's created this character, and she inhabits it. But off stage, she's just Annie Mae. So anyway, if you're as fascinated by Ike and Tina as an act and Tina as a person as I am, you must see and get this film, and wait until you hear the story behind how it came about. Bob Gruen, welcome back to Mr. Media.
I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you. I make no bones about my love of Tina Turner.
Well, she's quite popular. A lot of people like Tina Turner. She is amazing. All those words you said, she's everything you said.
I watch that, and as I'm watching it, I try to take myself out of it for a minute and think, okay, I'm you, and I'm sitting there watching this happen in front of me in 71, 72, the stage stuff, the you know, the personal stuff. What was that like? What's going through your head as you're recording all this?
Well, actually, I feel very blessed to have had the chance to get to know Ike and Tina and to spend so much time with them. It was always amazing. They were very powerful, very creative people. You know, even though I saw dozens of shows, I don't think I ever took it for granted. It wasn't like, oh, here's another show tonight. It was, wow, how lucky I am to see another show tonight. I always felt that. They're amazing people, and every show was great.
And you know, it's funny. Last night I was working up some notes for our interview today, and I was poking around on YouTube for Tina Turner clips. And I found someone, I think in Germany, had posted like an hour-long concert she did, or they had an hour of it.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting to me that what she does is very similar today, or whenever that was, a few years ago, to what you recorded in 71, 72. What was different, what I thought was lacking, was the musicianship behind her. It sounded like a Vegas-y stage review, someone's approximation of what Ike and Tina Turner review would sound like, but it just didn't have that.
A lot of times, you know, when acts get picked up by a major manager, the manager always wants to get better music, and so they get better musicians, and they get really professional musicians who can read the notes and really play the notes just exactly right, but very often it lacks the soul. And Ike and Tina Turner came from, you know, a soul review tradition, what they called the Chitlin' Circuit. You know, where all these different bands would play across the South, all these different clubs, and they did that for years, many years. And they were really used to it, and they were really surrounded by that kind of soul music sound. And the idea of entertaining an audience and getting the audience's attention and being entertaining rather than playing perfect music. Mm. You know, one of the things about rock and roll that's different from classical is you don't have to play rock and roll perfectly. In fact, there is no perfect.
Right.
Watch Chuck Berry. He bends notes into all kinds of off keys and minor keys. And he actually, somebody told me he plays piano keys on the guitar. And he often is out of tune, but he's rocking away, you know, and he gets the whole audience entertained. And that's what Ike and Tina do, is they were very good at entertaining and really knew how to work an audience. And very often when you get very professional musicians who are more used to working in the studio and getting every note perfectly right, you lose some of that spontaneous excitement. But Tina was always great, and her show was always great. And throughout the 80s, she became one of the most famous entertainers in the world. So it wasn't exactly bad, but it's different.
Right. You know?
It's kind of like when Janis Joplin had Big Brother and the Holding Company. And they were fantastic, amazingly fantastic. And then she got a bigger manager who said, these musicians aren't very good. You need good musicians. And when I saw her again with the good musicians, it sounded the way you described it, as kind of a Las Vegas-y show business kind of act. And she was still great. But you lose the soul. You lose the personality of the band.
That was it exactly. I mean, you could... You saw Tina for what she was. No matter where she is, she's still got that incredible talent.
She's amazing. She's unique. You know, I'm lucky in my life that I've seen a number of unique performers. You know, and it was around in the 80s they started comparing people, saying, well, this is like a Robert Plant type singer, but more with an Alice Cooper type of band. But nobody ever described Alice Cooper as like anybody, or Led Zeppelin wasn't like anybody, and Tina Turner certainly wasn't like anybody else. You know, she's an original.
Well, Bob, maybe you can fill folks in a little bit on the background of how this film came about in terms of your relationship with Ike and Tina. I'm guessing more with Ike on the business side of putting something like this together, and then. Why you happened to record what you did the way you did.
Well, it was more Tina Turner was in charge on stage. She was the show, but Ike Turner was certainly the business. He ran everything. Ike was quite a guy. He started out, you know, in the rural South, recorded one of the first rock and roll songs, Rocket 88. And he found out if you go to the studio, you get $10 for going to the studio. And if you bring another musician, you can be called a producer and you both get $10. So he became a producer. Pretty soon he became a booking agent. He opened a publishing company. He was quite smart and you know, really was in charge of everything. I was very lucky. I became a fan of Tina Turner the first time I saw her. They opened for the Rolling Stones. I think it was the first time I saw her. Then I saw them do their own kind of show as they opened for Sam and Dave, and I was mesmerized. Tina danced off the stage in a strobe light, and I just ended up watching the curtain. She disappeared behind, and I remember Sam and Dave kind of coming on and off, and I was still looking at the curtain waiting for Tina Turner to come back. And we went to see him a few days later, and I brought my camera, and I took a couple of pictures, and took pictures of the whole show. And towards the end of the show, the strobe light started flashing. I had no idea whether a picture would come out or not, but I took a chance and I set the camera for 1 second. I didn't know where to focus the camera because she was dancing in the strobe light. I didn't know what the exposure would be or the timing or anything, but I took a chance and I took a couple of pictures. And one of the pictures came out really well. It's kind of like the Duchamp nude descending the staircase. It really captures 5 different expressions of Tina in 1 second as she's dancing and her arm is moving up, her face is turning. And it's just a really exceptional picture. And the other pictures I got that night were pretty good, too. And I brought them with me to show my friends a few days later. And when we went to see another Ike and Tina show, they were playing in New Jersey. Because often when they'd get to an area, they'd play as many shows around that area as they could. And I brought the pictures to show my friends. And after the show, it turned out that the dressing rooms were outside. It was a theater in the round, and the dressing rooms were in trailers. And Ike Turner was walking from one trailer to another, and a friend of mine saw Ike. And literally pushed me in front of him and said, show Ike the pictures. And he stopped and said, what pictures, you know? So the pictures, he said, hey, these are pretty good. Come on in the dressing room. I want to show these to Tina. And we went in the dressing room and he showed them. And Tina liked them a lot. And I remember, I don't usually show people my contact prints. And she wanted to see them too. And she was liking every picture on the whole roll. And so Ike said he wanted to get in touch with me in New York when they came a couple of days later. And he was going to bring me to the record company. And it's kind of interesting in my life because a couple of days later they played at the Newport Folk Festival, Newport Jazz Festival, and I drove up there with the same friends. Actually, we drove up to see them, and on the way home, I was driving back. It had been a long day, and I pulled into the first rest area to get a cup of coffee, and everybody else in the car had fallen asleep. And as I got out of the car and the door closed behind me, 2 limousines pulled in right next to me, and the space is right there in the parking lot. And I stopped, you know, to see who was getting out of the limos, and it was the Ike and Tina band.
Wow.
So they were, you know, Ike recognized me from the night before, and he said, you know, I said I was just coming from seeing that show. He said, well, come on in and have breakfast with us. And so I started getting to know him right away. And when I saw him in New York on Monday, I believe I brought my video camera at that point. I think they were opening for the Beach Boys in Central Park. And the video camera was the very first portable video camera that was available in those days. It was made by Sony. It was called the Portapack. It was a reel-to-reel tape recorder. You had to thread the tape through the recorder. It was a 5-inch reel, and you threaded the tape through the recorder and carried the tape recorder on your shoulder. It was about a 50-pound box. The camera was a big thing, about this big, about four times the size of the box that a camera comes in today. There was no such thing as a cassette, certainly no hard drives or memories or anything like that. But it was a modern miracle, because you could get a roll of tape for $10 and you could just record continuously for half an hour. And then the real special part was you didn't have to get it developed or processed as you did with film. Film, if you wanted to, you know, before that, if anybody wanted to see themselves, you had to get a film camera, spend a lot of money on film, film the show, and then get the film developed and processed. And then a couple of days later, you'd get a projector and you'd go somewhere to watch the film. With the video, we can make a video of the show and with the band go right back into the dressing room or into the hotel, plug it into the TV in the hotel room, and watch it back immediately. So the band really liked that. It was the first time they could actually see themselves right after a show from the audience point of view. Even if you did a TV show back then, they were rarely recorded. Often there was a kinescope, which is a film process again, and they would never get to see it. So this way they could actually get to see their show right after they played it. And Tina really liked it because she could point out things that the iCats were doing in their routines to improve the routine, different ways of turning and dancing. So they started liking me to come around and videotape the shows, and they liked the photos I was taking. So we just developed a relationship where we were doing it more and more, and it was never really a formal, we're going to hire you to come this weekend. Whenever we had time, we would take a weekend off, we'd go meet them. Ike would see us there, they'd let us in, give us full access, give me a couple $100 bills at the end of the weekend to cover whatever expenses I had, and that's the way we worked it.
And how much experience did you have at that point with the video camera? Because it seemed like you were learning as you went.
Oh, yeah. We definitely were learning as we went. I think I had just gotten the camera a few months before I met Ike and Tina. But the early footage, almost all that we did was with Ike and Tina. Like, we really started working with them. They were a lot of fun to work with. The Ikeettes and the band guys, all enjoyed having their picture taken. They were all very upbeat, very friendly people. So we had a lot of fun filming them. A couple of years later, I went on and made a documentary, a film with the New York Dolls that we released with the same company, MVD. We released two videos of the New York Dolls called All Dolled Up and Looking Fine on Television. Now we finally got around to editing all this Ike and Tina footage, which I'm really happy to finally, get it out there. It's been more than 40, 45 years ago. But it's still fresh. And then today, so many people, because Tina became so popular and so world famous, everyone knows who Tina Turner is. And a lot of people have heard of Ike. But no one's actually seen Ike, and certainly have never seen Ike and Tina, because there's so little footage of them. There may be a clip from the Tammy show or a little bit of footage from some other TV show they did. But there's almost nothing available of the Ike and Tina review, and nothing like this kind of footage where it's really intimate, traveling with them. We even went home with Tina. We went in the studio with Ike. We had pretty full access. We really got along on a friend basis. We liked each other. We liked being with each other. And they were very open with us. And I'm really glad, they wanted.
There were two things I wanted to ask you about that struck me as missing from the film, and I just wondered if that was conscious or unconscious, or maybe it just didn't happen. But the first thing was it struck me that as you were traveling around with them, I'd be very surprised if they weren't encountering some form, I'd say it, but some form of racism on the road.
Well, actually, not a lot that I noticed. It's not like they went to places where they weren't going to be allowed in. They had been around for a long time. They knew what the situation in America was, although it wasn't the 50s anymore. It wasn't even the 60s. In the early 70s, I remember Bo Diddley cooking fried chicken in his dressing room because he said he was tired of having to go to the back window in a restaurant in order to get food. But those days were pretty much over. When I was with Argentina, we went to pretty normal restaurants on occasion. Their audience was primarily white, because of rock and roll audience. It wasn't so much of a soul audience. They were really one of the early crossover acts where they were primarily a black act that was really appealing to a white audience. So I didn't see very much prejudice towards them. And that's why it's not in the film. I didn't really see it. People like Tina.
Okay. It was fresh in my mind. I was listening to an older interview with Bill Cosby, the comedian, obviously. He was talking about the 60s and the early 70s and traveling, and that there were places that he couldn't stay. He's still, even at that point, that, you know.
But more likely the early 60s, and certainly before that, 50s, 40s, whatever. By the end of the 60s, there was a lot of civil rights movement. The Civil Rights Act had been passed. There was a lot more awareness of prejudice and segregation. And segregation was illegal, which it hadn't been before. Mm. So I don't think that really came up.
Okay.
You know, for me, Ike and Tina were never a black act. It was a rock and roll act. You know, and to most of their audience, as I say, most of their audience was white. So that really didn't come up, you know, the black and white issue.
All right. And then the other thing that I noticed, there's very little of we get a whole lot of Tina's personality. We get a whole lot of kind of private moments with her, off stage moments. Very little with Ike. There's a moment of him in the studio, there's not a lot of him talking, interacting with Tina off stage, with family.
Ike was very much in charge off stage, but no, he didn't actually talk a lot. He didn't chat very much, you know. He didn't do interviews. Actually, watching the film, I didn't even remember, because I don't think I was aware of so much at the time, but he has a stutter, you know, pronounced stutter, and he may have been embarrassed about that. And that might have kept him from participating in the interviews. Ike was a very smart guy. Very intelligent, very quick mind, and very perceptive. And he would look at you with these deep eyes and kind of not just look into your eyes, but look into your brain all the way down to the soles of your feet. But when you talked to Ike, you were connected to him, you know. But that doesn't come really across on the video. And a lot of the work in the studio is repetitious. So the scenes that we've shown where he's talking about the piano or he's talking about, you know, getting certain parts right, they kind of do that over and over again when you're in a recording studio. I don't know if you've been with this in a studio. It's not exciting. You know, it goes over and over, and the song is 3 or 4 minutes long, and they do it again and again and again. And a videotape, you don't want to see 42 takes of the same thing. But Ike was very much in charge. But no, he didn't really talk a lot, and certainly he never did interviews.
I felt like you gave a sense of that in that there's a clip from Ike and Tina on the on Johnny Carson on the Tonight Show.
Yeah, but Johnny says, "Okay, Ike, you can say anything you want." He just laughed.
It was nothing.
Totally in charge on stage, but very much Tina was the spokesperson. Ike was very quiet in public.
And, Bob, where were you in your career when you met them, and how did being around them a lot and then doing the video at the time affect your career going forward?
Well, I was beginning to get some recognition. I was beginning to work with more and more groups, but still it was very early in my career. It was about a year after I met Ike and Tina. I mean, certainly that was the first band I traveled with, was Ike and Tina Turner. And about a year after I met them, I was involved with a book. I was included in a book, the very first book on rock photography, I think called The Photography of Rock. And I know the Tina Turner pictures are in there. And one picture, I just met John and Yoko in, I think, November of 71. And it was actually while we were staying in Los Angeles, at one point in 72, I went and did some photos of John and Yoko. And for a magazine, and then I gave them to the magazine. I left town, and we were on the road with Ike and Tina for about 2 weeks, at which point I just felt a driving urge that I had to be back in New York City. I think the main excuse was that I had to file my taxes on time, and we had been away for 2 weeks. And I just had to get back and take care of things, and Ike wanted me to stay and keep filming, and I just insisted I had to go home for at least a couple of days. And, you know, sometimes my intuition is right, because the day I came home for 2 days, and the night I came home, I ran into the drummer from the Elvin's Memory Band. He said that John and Yoko had wanted to use my pictures in their album cover. And the next day he took me to their apartment, and that's when I actually met them.
Wow.
So I was really just kind of beginning to kind of shift into second or third gear on my career and really get going. I would say second, you know, when I met John and Yoko. And I hadn't even met the New York Dolls yet. They were just starting around then. Mm-hmm. Actually, the Elephant's Memory Band, I was working with John and Yoko, that had the same management as the New York Dolls. And when I brought some Elephant's Memory pictures to their manager's office, they said, well, you should check out this other band we were. And then I met the New York Dolls, and one thing led to another. 2 years later, when they were breaking up, Malcolm McLaren came and, you know, helped them out in their last days. And when I went to England a year after that, Malcolm was the only person I knew, and he introduced me to the Sex Pistols and the Clash and Billy Idol and Susie of the Banshees and a whole bunch of people like that. So my life has always been kind of a snowball that's just been getting bigger and bigger, and I just follow it along and keep up with it, you know. Like I said, I hadn't met some of the bigger acts I ever worked with. We were John and Yoko and New York Dolls. I think I had just met Elton John. He was a new unknown piano player from England who was opening for Leon Russell. Mm-hmm. So it was very early in my career. And Argentina were a great act to learn from because they knew the business from the ground up. You know, Ike always liked to be paid before he went on stage. You know, little take care of business things like that I learned. And traveling with them and just having a great time with them.
And what you obviously have a lot of respect and a lot of love for Ike, who, you know, has not fared well in history over the years. You know, what would you want someone to know about the Ike that you knew in the 70s?
Well, Ike was actually a very generous person and a very creative person and helped out many different artists, myself included. But I went to his funeral a couple of years ago. There was over 1,000 people there. Almost all of them because I could help them. Yeah. Very often anonymously, usually without asking for anything back. Ike always just did the right thing. Somebody needed something and he had it, he gave it. If you needed a car, a house, if you needed, you know, help getting rid of a boyfriend, whatever it was, help him. He got a really bad rap in the movie, What's Love Got to Do with It? They didn't make that up. You know, I think that the movie could have been subtitled, What Happens to a Good Guy Who Takes Too Much Cocaine? You know, cocaine can drive a lot of people really crazy. It's a very hard thing to get over. Ike fought with it for the rest of his life trying to get off it. But I don't think that was, you know, really the whole of his personality. If you talk to anybody who knew Ike, they'll have wonderful things to say about him. He was a very dynamic, very dramatic kind of guy. And like I say, a very generous, very giving person. Little Richard, King Solomon Burke, Phil Spector, a lot of people spoke at his funeral in very high terms of what a wonderful guy he was.
And after
what I like to say about this video is that a lot of people saw What's Love Got to Do with It, and they understand why Ike and Tina broke up. And I think there were very good reasons why they broke up. I don't think Tina did anything wrong. I think it was lucky of her to be able to escape at that time. But our film is going to show why they were together for 25 years before that.
And there is a moment in the film backstage. Yeah. Sorry. There's a moment backstage between them. Well, no, it's between Tina and another woman. And Tina's talking about this other woman, and I'm not sure who it was, having a real interest in Ike, and you were really interested in Ike. And I thought that kind of hinted at Ike's interest, or maybe wandering eye, whatever it may be.
Ike and Tina's marriage was not a traditional marriage. Ike had many girlfriends. Mm. Tina mostly was home taking care of the kids. If she had a boyfriend, nobody knew about it. But Ike certainly had a lot of girlfriends that everybody knew about. It wasn't a hidden thing. It wasn't, you know, he's cheating on her kind of thing. It was quite obvious. It's the way they lived. They were both married when they met. And they had one child together, but there's about 4 or 5 kids in the house. Some of them are Tina's, some of them are Ike's. One of them is Ike and Tina's, and one is someone, another woman who was also there taking care of the kids with Tina. It wasn't a traditional match. You know, and that's what other people, a lot of people don't understand, because what's love got to do with it? Kind of showed them living in the house together as a traditional couple, and that didn't happen.
Interesting.
And it's made up.
Did in terms of getting this this film to us, to the public, were there a lot of rights issues that you had to deal with? Did you have to get permission from Tina, for example, since she's surviving this?
She gave up all her rights to Ike and Tina in their divorce.
Oh.
I think she all she wanted was to keep was her name. She just wanted it out, and she left everything to Ike, and we got permission from Ike's estate to make the film. Tina asked us to be kind to her, and I think we have been. I'm very fond of both of them. They were both very good to me. I wouldn't want to insult either one of them. And I think the film kind of shows what their relationship was like without pointing any fingers. I didn't ever see Ike hit Tina, so I don't have any footage of that kind of scene. It's not that it was left out, which isn't to say it didn't happen. If you hit somebody once, you can just raise your hand or just kind of raise your eyebrow for the next 5 years, and that person will cringe. You know, violence can be very destructive without having to actually be physical. And so, but like I say, you know, what I saw was a couple that was, you know, a hardworking couple, that they were doing business together, they were working together. I didn't really see them living together. By the time I saw Ike, he was, I wouldn't say on a 24/7 schedule or even a 48/7 schedule. I mean, that guy was awake most of the time.
Wow. Interesting.
She had a much more normal lifestyle. She was not high on drugs. She didn't drink. She was taking care of the children. She was, you know, cooking at home for the kids and eating, you know, and sleeping regular. They had a very different lifestyle.
Now, let's talk about you for a minute. The film is credited to Nadia and Bob Gruen, the former Nadia Beck, I think. Tell us a little bit about who was doing what, and you both do pop in and out of the film at times.
Right. Nadia, well, that's the way, it's kind of a funky film. You know, we were making it somewhat as a home movie. We didn't really know what we were going to do with it. The fact that it's coming out as a DVD and it's going to be available, I mean, the idea of being available on the internet like this wasn't even dreamed of back then. The problem with the Portapak video was that you couldn't show it anywhere except from the machine that you made it on or a similar machine. If somebody didn't have that specific videotape machine, they couldn't play it. We couldn't really copy it very well. It was very hard to edit. And so it was kind of funky. We were really kind of doing it as a hobby. Mm-hmm. Doing it for the band mostly so they could see themselves afterwards. And Ike really liked the idea of our making a documentary, and he encouraged us to do more. And in fact, the color scenes in the film were when I came back from that little trip to New York. Ike had watched some of the footage, and he liked what we were doing, but he didn't like the quality so much. He wanted us to shoot color and to shoot film. And so you talk about learning as we go. I went down to the film rental big building in Hollywood down there, and I rented an Eclair camera because I'd heard Godard and Pembacker used them. I had no idea what it was, but I heard it was a good one. The Nagra tape recorder because I heard that was a good one. And I got little instruction books with them, which I had no time to open the next day, because that night I came back with the equipment and we were off to San Francisco. And I remember Ike looking at the equipment saying, that won't fit in the plane. They were taking a little private plane. And he said, here's the keys. And he gave me the keys to Tina's Jaguar and said, meet us in San Francisco. You know, from New York, I thought New York, Philadelphia, it was like an hour and a half or 2 hours away. I didn't realize how far San Francisco really is from Los Angeles. It's a long drive. It's about 450 miles. But we drove up there, and then the next day I broke out all the film equipment. I didn't even know how to start the thing. And I took it out on the sidewalk with my instruction books and some of the ICAS, and we were going to try and, you know, get the thing up and running. And some kids came by. Like, I'm blessed with angels in my life. And some kids saw us with the camera, and they came over, and they said, oh, are you making a film? And we said, yeah, we are. And they said, oh, well, we're film students. Can we help you? And I said, well, we can. Can you tell me where the on switch is? How do I put this camera on? And I thought that was, you know, I should have known a little more. But anyway, I said, you like rock and roll? You want to come to an Argentina show tonight? And they came along to the show, and they taught me everything I know about filmmaking in that one night.
Oh, wow.
And so the film footage, as you'll see, is a little funky, but that kind of makes it fit in with the black and white mono quality of the rest of the film. Mm. I'm glad they could use some of the color footage. It really adds a lot, particularly in the opening and closing sequence in the back of the car. I think it's really great the way they open it and close it like that, with them, you know, teasing and kidding around and getting along so well.
It was one of my questions was actually about the color, so I'm glad you addressed that. Let me ask you a different question. I recently had the experience of coming upon an interview that I did, an audio interview that I did with Frank Zappa. It was 1978, and I was 1 month into my freshman year of college. I didn't know anything about Zappa. I got all my information. It's like getting it from like a bad source on the internet. I got it from the two guys in the dorm room next to me who were total stoners, and everything that they thought they knew about Zappa was basically what we would call an urban legend. Mm. But I didn't know any better. The internet hadn't been invented yet. So I went to him and asked him all these horrible, horrible questions. And I to listen to it, and we just posted it a few days ago. You know, it's kind of a lost interview. But to listen to it makes my skin crawl. A, I sound awful, but B, what's coming out of my mouth and the production value of it just made me crazy. How, you know, when you look at this 40-some-year-old video of I, Cantina, what do you think? How do you feel?
Well, a lot of times I wish I could have got certain parts in focus better. You know, we had some more light, or I wish I had a better angle, or, you know, I wish I knew how important it would turn out to be. Like I say, it was really just a hobby. We weren't making it for anybody. You know, we were just having fun filming because it was so inexpensive to do it. But I see it, and I'm really happy that we made it because it is the only document of its kind. It's the only actual footage of Ike and Tina being themselves, you know, at home and in interviews and on stage and so on. So in spite of how funky it was, I wanted the quality to be better, but we couldn't afford a big production. You know, in those days, to get better quality, you had to get a whole committee, you had to get a lot of budget to shoot film and recording and so on. You know, and so we knew we were basically making a Polaroid record of it, you know, simple as mono, as black and white. But we were very happy that we had something, and we were showing it to our friends, and, you know, people liked it. So I did actually have a channel it was actually around 72, I think, or so, when they started putting in cable TV in New York. Part of the deal with the city was that they had to have two channels that were open to the public called Public Access, mm-hmm. which was pretty much available to anybody who could make a video on a first-come, first-served basis. You just went and signed up. There was no censorship. You could put anything you wanted on. And so I signed up for a half hour and an hour pretty much every week, and we were showing the videos. I also went to some of the clubs who were taping everybody from Willie Dixon to Larry Coryell to eventually the New York Dolls and Blondie and Patti Smith and groups like that, and putting them on the cable channel. But other than that, and the cable channel, it only went out to a few people. Because, you know, it was kind of expensive, and a lot of buildings weren't wired yet. They were still, you know, week by week wiring the city up. So it was really... It's just something that we did as a labor of love, just something to do. And now I'm really glad we did, because it's a history that people finally get to see. You know, like I say, people have heard about Ike and Tina, but very few people have actually seen them.
Will we get to see any of those other band tapes, or are they in release otherwise?
Well, that gets back to the rights and clearances issues. You know, we were lucky, you know, it took 30 years before the Dolls reformed, and then they had a manager who could make a deal, and we finally got the Dolls films out. You know, and with Ike and Tina, like I say, with Ike, there was a couple of times over the years we kept talking about doing something and never did. And so finally we were able to get that out. The other bands, some of the bands don't get along with each other. The members, you know, are still in lawsuits or remember the lawsuits. And it's a little difficult to get some of the clearances. But as we get clearances for things, we would like to put them out. Yeah.
Well, let me close with this, because you're sitting in a very interesting place, I suspect. Behind you are all these file cabinets. tell me, what's if we had more equipment, if we had a cameraman there, and we opened up some of these file cabinets, would we be looking at photos from your career?
Oh yeah, this is my life story behind me here. It's actually very interesting. If you read the labels, we have like Ryan Adams to Penny Arcade. We have Nina Hagen to Richard Hell. What do we got? Elvis Costello to the Psycho Sluts from Hell. What's that one over there? Bob Marley to Malcolm McLaren.
Wow.
M's. These are all file cabinets of my photos. Nowadays, we've been digitizing a lot. Of course, it all ends up in the computer scans nowadays. You got to get with the program and, you know, live in the modern world. But yeah, this is kind of an archive. I've lived in this studio I've been in the building since 1970. I've been in this studio since 1975, which is about 37 years. So there is a lot of history in here.
It's very cool. It's one of the things I like about doing the video interviews this way is we get to see people kind of in their element. And
Well, I could turn it around a little more, but it's kind of full of stuff right now. I've been on a holiday, and then there's a lot of things laying around today we have to clean up.
It's very cool, though. Well, listen, folks, you can find Ike and Tina on the Road, 1971-72 by Nadia and Bob Gruen, in great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching the video, probably right below the video is the picture of the DVD cover, and you can click on that. It'll take you to Amazon. You can order it right now, get it over with, and you're going to love it. If you have any love for Ike and Tina, you will absolutely adore this film.
Geek footage, there's a part too where I really like about three quarters of the way through. I think so I smell trouble or something. I feel trouble. Where Ike just goes off on the guitar. You know, Ike and Tina do this scat, call and response kind of thing where he mimics her voice and then he just takes off on a guitar solo and he does it so effortlessly. You know, I'm happy that people will finally get to see what a great musician he is and what a great team they were together.
I actually have a note to myself. I was going to ask you about that. Is it, it there is that moment. It's I Smell Trouble, I think, is the tune. And it's we get to see Tina sing and dance throughout the whole film. Even backstage quite a bit, which is really cool. But there's that one point in I Smell Trouble where we get to see what the excitement about Ike really was and that incredible playing.
And he just lets go on the guitar. And I don't know any guitar player. I've shown it to a few of my friends, and they all are just amazed. People didn't know he could do that. They didn't know anybody could do that because he just does it so casually.
And I guess before we go, Bob, is there if people want to know more about your work, is there a website or where can they find you online?
We're revising it soon. It's still kind of a primitive site that we set up about 12 years ago. So please don't write me letters telling me it's going to be revised. We know that. But yeah, BobGruen.com. It's got all my pictures up there, ways to contact me, and so on. And I have a feature called Photo of the Day, which is more like photo of the season, but it shows where I've been and what I've been doing, and I try to keep it relatively current. So check out BobGruen.com. You'll see my other books. I just put out a book called Racine. I would give a little plug for that.
Sure.
If I got Racine, my new coffee table tone, it makes a great Christmas gift. 500 of my favorite photos in this one book here, and we're very proud of it. It's really quite a gift. It's got silver letters. You don't even have to wrap it. It just looks like a gift. It's too. So Racine, S-E-E-N. You can also get that on Amazon while you're buying the Ike and Tina tape.
Absolutely. We'll put up a link to that as well. Bob, it was great to have you back today. Great to see you this time. And please come back whenever you have new product, or you just want to share some of your incredible stories. They're really fun to listen to.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest two-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority, for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.